Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And at the end of the week, pictures of the U.S. economy and the latest jobs report, which was guardedly positive. We'll talk about that later in the hour. Also, pictures of the alarming, unforeseen consequences of two wars for some American veterans struggling to move on with their lives. Can Afghanistan move on from three decades of civil war? We'll explore some ghosts of the old Soviet Union afoot in Afghanistan and in Eastern Europe, thinking about the alarming new face of Russia's Vladimir Putin. And our Friday concludes with the resolution of our TV Greats competition. Can Mary Richards surpass Hawkeye from MASH or Lieutenant Commander Data, the android from Star Trek TNG? Who's the TV all-time great on The Takeaway? Well, you can decide by voting at thetakeaway.org. But first, a second terrible shooting rampage at Fort Hood Military Base, which was the scene of so much violence back in 2009 when a soldier opened fire. We're learning details that this week's shooter, who killed himself on Wednesday, was being treated for mental illness, anxiety, and being evaluated for PTSD. He served in Egypt from 2007 to January 2008 and in Iraq for 6 months in 2011. Marjorie Morrison joins us now, CEO and founder of the Military and Civilian Resilience Training Program, PsychArmor. She's also a psychotherapist and author of The Inside Battle, Our Military Mental Health Crisis. Marjorie, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, Marjorie, let's begin. How long have you been observing the military mental health care systems and the VA trying to deal with all the mental health consequences for troops back home from these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I started about a decade ago, dabbled in it a little bit, did some short-term anonymous confidential contracts where I went on a base and did a little bit of, you know, anonymous counseling. But I got pretty deep into it in about 2008, where I spent a year on the Marine Corps Recruit Training Depot. And I, at that point in time, was put in a counseling office and realized that these weren't men that were ever going to come, most likely were not going to come in for counseling. So through that, we created a proactive counseling program, and we found that to be a really effective way to bring services to them.
When you look at the situation at Fort Hood this week, how much of this is the military really creating problems for itself by not dealing with this in a proactive way? And how much of this is just the extraordinary difficulty of all of these troops, both of these wars, and how long this has gone on?
You know, I think it's a combination of both of those. You know, when you look at the Fort Hood incident, I don't know that we can really say this was a PTSD issue, right? Because he didn't properly have that diagnosis and he didn't see combat. So I think this case might fall into not that different of one like Sandy Hook or the Navy Yard, because it sounds like in that particular situation, right, his mom and his grandmother had just recently passed away in the last few weeks. And that might have been what set him over the edge. I mean, I think that when we look at it from a systemic standpoint, all of these things are sort of manifestations of stress that are not able to properly get dealt with. And so they it becomes more catastrophic.
Mm. You know, I've done reporting on this. And at the beginning of the Iraq war, the military made a decision, at least according to reporting that I and some other reporters did, to not baseline screen the troops going into combat for anxiety issues, PTSD issues, the potential for mental illness. And it really creates a pattern. I'm wondering if, in your experience, the military has a problem with preventive strategies on mental health, that they'd much prefer to deal with it on the back end.
I could not agree with you more. I mean, we just cannot seem to move them into that direction. I believe that they try, but it's a check in the box. It's a, let's do a suicide prevention, everybody go in theater, and, you know, here it is. But what they haven't been able to do is to look at that prevention individually, which I say, you know, every single one of us has a propensity to what happens to us when we're under stress, right? Some people drink too much, some people socially isolate, some people spend too much money. And so if you learn what happens to you and you learn remedies that you can put into place when such a thing occurs, you have an exponentially better chance of it not turning into some horrible event. And yet the military will teach individually physical health, right? They have physical training, but not mental health. Right?
Do you believe that there are preventive strategies that can deal with things like PTSD and post-combat consequences?
Absolutely. I mean, just from my own personal experience, I spent a year at MCRD and I put 500 to 600 drill instructors through mandatory individual and group counseling. And it was a phenomenal program. And everybody that was part of it thought that that was the answer. Then we went to Camp Pendleton and we designed the same similar program on a larger scale, had buy-in from the general, the colonel of the 1st Marine Regiment. It was that group of 4,500 young men or all infantry. I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of Marines to understand what really are the issues. And we wrote a great program. We just were never able to get it off the ground.
So what's standing in the way before we go?
Well, I mean, for one is that we needed this credential and you couldn't get the credential without a program of record, but you can't get a program of record because of sequestration. So we hit a dead end there. We went to headquarters Marine Corps. We had a 06 Navy captain psychiatrist present the program. I mean, this is a lot of guys on the ground, you know, who are high level, but doing the work, say, hey, this is what we need. And yet headquarters Marine Corps said, okay, we listened to your presentation. We're going to put it in a committee. And 7 months later, we got a form letter saying, sorry, it's been denied because of duplication of services. We went to Congress. A congressman wrote a letter to the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Navy launched an investigation. And that was in December. And we haven't heard anything yet. So meanwhile, it's a year and a half later.
And so frustrating given what's happened at Fort Hood this week, even though, as you say, it might not be directly related to these kind of preventive strategies, but more needs to be done. Marjorie, thanks so much.
You bet.
Marjorie Morrison is CEO and founder of the Military and Civilian Resilience Training Program, Psych Armor. She's a psychotherapist and author of The Inside Battle, Our Military Mental Health Crisis. Thanks so much. Two voices now on the political legacy of the war in Afghanistan and America's broader war on terror. The nation-building mission in the former home of the Taliban is being tested this weekend in elections on Saturday. President Hamid Karzai says farewell, and the Afghan people have a chance to begin a changing of the guard.
This time, it is possible and necessary to use the opportunity and go and vote. Yes, there might be difficulties and security problems. Nevertheless, the overall preparations, the overall atmosphere is much better.
That's United Nations Special Representative to Afghanistan, Jan Kubisch, this week speaking about the shadow of violence hanging over these Afghan elections. Violence threatening civilians and against journalists has brought Kabul to an uneasy calm as the polling begins. From Kabul, BBC reporter Bilal Sarawi joins us. Welcome.
Thank you.
What message does the so-called non-state actors in Afghanistan want the world to see as people go to the polls in Afghanistan?
There has been quite a lot of violence ahead of the elections, but the Afghan government says that they are confident that the elections will take place. There will be security incidents. But if you talk to normal, ordinary Afghans across the country and many provinces, more and more people are telling us that they will take part in tomorrow's elections because this means more stability, more prosperity for the country, and they do admit that there are security risks that they would be taking.
If this is a vote for stability and security in Afghanistan, who are the candidates that people believe are most likely to deliver that?
Well, there are at least seven candidates. The three are very prominent. They are Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, who was the former foreign minister in President Karzai's government. And then you've got Dr. Zalmay Rasool, who was the former foreign minister. But he was also someone who was always close to the former king of Afghanistan. And then you have Dr. Ashraf Ghani, who served as the finance minister. And he also was a professor at Johns Hopkins. So the three doctors, as people call them these days, are the three people who are seen as the front-run candidates for the country's presidency.
Are these unifying figures, or do we see Afghanistan voting along, ethnic and some would say tribal lines in this election?
Well, it's interesting. There were rallies all over the country, and Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, for example, who's got mixed Tajik Pashtun background, was able to travel along with his Hazara in Pashtun vice presidents all over the country. One of his vice presidents, Hazara leader, even spoke in Pashto in Kandahar, and that was simply not something that one could have imagined, because Afghanistan, you have to remember, comes out of a very painful past. Only in 1992, a lot of these vice presidents were fighting each other. So in those terms, people see it as a huge change, and people are more and more optimistic. And it's remarkable that there were at least 400 campaign rallies taking place under very tough security threats. And many of these rallies included hundreds, if not all of them, thousands of supporters for each and every of these candidates.
Speaking to us from Kabul, BBC reporter Bilal Sarwawi is talking about the upcoming Afghanistan elections. Bilal, what will be the visibility of ISAF, NATO, and U.S. troops during this election? Will they be very much behind the scenes or very much visible?
Well, Afghanistan's Interior Minister Omar Dawoodzai was speaking at a press conference yesterday. He said, this is very much the Afghanization. The Afghans are taking charge. This is the pride of the Afghan people to have an election. We've got 450,000 Afghan National Security Forces. All of them are ready to serve, provide security. All of them are busy. But he made it very clear, NATO was an ally, NATO was a friend, and they had trained troops. So if we needed help, NATO would be there. And at one stage, Mr. Dawoodzai even admitted that NATO helicopters was used to transport sensitive stuff, ballot boxes, into some of Afghanistan's most remote or dangerous areas. The Afghan government is very much looking up to NATO for air support and any other help.
Finally, how nervous is the press corps in Kabul as we begin this very, very sensitive moment? Certainly, journalists have been targeted and have been victims of some of the violence.
Well, I think there are so many broken hearts, to say the least, and I think I'll be speaking for a number of my colleagues. You would remember that two of our colleagues were shot in the southeastern province of Khost, two female journalists working for the Associated Press, when a police officer opened fire, killing the photographer and injuring one of the correspondents. And Kathy Gannon, the reporter, she's in stable conditions. Kathy Gannon is someone who's been visiting the country since 1980s. She was here telling the story of Afghanistan to the world when we couldn't be here, when Afghanistan was going through the fight against Soviets, the civil war, the Taliban. So she was very committed, and she has many friends here, including the president of Afghanistan, who she knew from the 80s. So a lot of people are quite shocked and heartbroken after what has happened today.
Commenting on recent violence in Afghanistan and the upcoming elections, Bilal Sarwawi is a Kabul reporter for the BBC, speaking to us from Kabul. Bilal, thanks so much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
More thoughts on Afghanistan coming up. Later this hour, three characters left in our final TV Greats Elimination Tournament. Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Data from Star Trek, and Hawkeye Pierce from MASH. Your votes determine the winner. Who are you behind from Grand Prairie, Texas? Mary Richards, strong single career woman with fantastic fashion. Bel Air, Maryland. Hawkeye, most human, most intelligent, wry and cynical and hopeful all in one. And Little Rock, Arkansas, Data. He strives to be less perfect while the rest of us are busy worrying about being more perfect. Succinct, fantastic. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us which character is your pick for best TV character of all time. And you can cast your vote at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Our next voice on the history-making elections in Afghanistan says this weekend's polling will be a first in a couple of ways. The nation is not under occupation and also not under the thumb of Islamist insurgents such as the Taliban, despite the violence. The tentative emergence of Afghanistan as a nation-state rather than as a sanctuary for terrorists or heroin traffickers will also be the swan song for Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who has led Afghanistan for 12 years and steps down. Three candidates are seen as favorites in the balloting, including Dr. Zalmai Rasool.
It is the first time, as I mentioned in our history, that a transition of power will go from one elected president to another political exit. And that's crucial, because if he succeeds to have an election in which the result is accepted by the majority of the Afghan people, I firmly believe that the democratic process will be rooted in the Afghan society forever.
Dr. Rasool speaking last year about what is at stake right now in Afghanistan. Faisal Ali Khan is a Carnegie Fellow at the New America Foundation. He says the future of Afghanistan is no longer in the hands of the nation's old guard of politicians, whatever the outcome in the weekend polling. With this election, Hamid Karzai, for the first time in more than a decade, no longer has the capacity to pull strings in this fragile new nation.
I think of very much a transitional figure. He inherited in Afghanistan in 2001, which was a very difficult situation. The U.S. ambassador at the time, Ambassador Khalilzad, was practically, you know, running the country for some time because of the massive involvement by ISAF, etc. So moving all the way from a president like that to such a strong president as he is today and having this peaceful democratic transition is quite a change in the way the country has sort of, you know, progressed over the last decade.
And so what of the Karzai regime, the Karzai style, the Karzai legacy survives? Or is the candidacy that will succeed the one that's best able to distance themselves from Hamid Karzai?
A lot of people speak about the nepotism. A lot of people speak about corruption, which is ingrained in government, and so many of these factors which they associate with the Karzai administration. I sometimes feel that it's a bit unfair, given the fact that what he inherited in 2001, there have been so many international actors and players. And although we've all spoken about Afghan-led and Afghan-owned, there's been a lot of involvement and micromanagement by the donors and the international community in various aspects of the country. So given the situation and the conditions, I think some of the positive things of the legacy is the fact that there have been several elections for provincial council members, for MPs, that you now have women in parliament. You have a very successful national program and the National Solidarity Program, which is all across the country and has sort of broken this mud curtain, as it were. So there are lots of positive things. The negative things which people seem to focus on in the media is this things like nepotism, corruption, and all the people around him that have benefited. And those are things that perhaps the candidates coming in would like to distance themselves from.
A number of the candidates have said statements along this line, particularly in looking to the West and trying to reassure the West that democracy is alive and well in Afghanistan, that regarding the Taliban, the train is leaving the station. They need to get on board and be a part of the democratic process or be forever exiled, really, from any relevance in Afghanistan. Do you think that holds, that that's for real? And is the Taliban inclined to do something like that?
I don't think that that holds, because I feel that on one side you have this urbanized sort of youth and people who've been, you know, educated and close to foreign observers, international community, etc. People in the rural areas and in the south, I mean, I think one of the things that sometimes is not addressed as much is the heavy influence of the narcotics industry and narcotics trade and their influence with some of the anti-state elements and the vested interests who want to prolong the conflict. So there are certain parts of the country where there have been shadow administrations of anti-state elements. And I think that at some stage, that's one of the root causes in terms of funding, sustenance, or vested interest. If those things are not addressed, it makes it difficult into bringing or including some of these people into the process. Given the fact that there's been economic development and people have benefited, there's more benefit in them having a peace dividend than, you know, things going towards a civil war.
The West, I suspect, in America particularly, so fatigued by the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, would be happy and would consider a huge success Afghanistan's invisibility going forward, and any recognition that Afghanistan might be returning to a sanctuary for al-Qaeda would be viewed as a huge negative. But from the perspective of Afghans, there must be a different measure of success going forward in this election. What do you think it is?
Those who have benefited from this war economy and who have an interest in economic state in wanting there to be more of a presence of the international community, you know, are the ones who would probably be, you know, vying for the West to stay, etc. I think after 10 years, most common Afghans would like some amount of a distance. I think they want the presence of some of the Western troops, not so much to curb the Taliban, but to prevent infighting between the various factions, you know, within the country. I think it's important that the West, you know, maintains a level of commitment with Afghanistan and has a sort of relationship with them, but, you know, is not seen to be micromanaging. Because if you leave a vacuum, then that's going to lead to other regional players that will be interfering or, you know, probably being interventionist in that region, as they have demonstrated in the past.
Finally, before we go, who are the surprise voices here? If democracy is successful and this election is a success, and over the next 4 or 5 years we see a growth in Afghanistan, what voices are we going to hear from that will grow? Will they be women? Will they be young people? Will they be entrepreneurs? Who are we going to hear from that we haven't heard from in the past?
I think it's the youth, really. It's the younger people who, because of the youth bubble in the country, there's one aspect of them or one side of them who are, you know, in media, who are in the larger cities, very vocal, and are able to get their message out. There's another side where you have rural youth in, you know, more far-flung parts of the country, many of whom have also been targeted by these anti-state actors because of a lack of opportunity. They've sort of moved towards, you know, anti-democratic forces. But even them, as part of an inclusive, you know, government, which is more accessible to the people, I think these are the voices that are really going to demonstrate change, who don't carry the baggage of the past, the baggage of their fathers or grandfathers, for a new Afghanistan, a new vision of where they see the country going and, you know, what they'd like for the future.
Faisal Ali Khan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Faisal Ali Khan is co-founder and CEO of the Foundation for Integrated Development Action, a nonprofit organization in Pakistan. Big story today, the Labor Department released the unemployment report for the month of March. A rise in payrolls of about 192,000 and an unemployment rate steady 6.7%. Trend, blip, it's another one of those ambiguous verdicts on the U.S. economy. But for people in the category of the long-term unemployed, the verdict is more clearly negative. These job numbers don't really reach them. With a profile of what all this means, Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC Radio, joins us. Hey, Charlie.
Good morning.
So, you know, again, it's just kind of plugging along.
It's plugging along, and I think the bigger problem that we still continue to face is an economy that just really isn't – it's doing okay. It's sputtering along. It's growing, but not at the level that you really would see perhaps more jobs being posted, more people being hired. And, of course, if you are one of the long-term unemployed, which is about a third of the overall unemployment workforce right now – it's just really difficult to find a job. You lose skills. You lack some of the training that you might need for new jobs. There's also a sense that people lose the stamina to keep looking for work the longer they're out. And a big problem, of course, is, you know, this subtle discrimination that companies have against people who've been unemployed. There have been studies that have found that you are more likely to get a job if you don't actually have the experience for the job, but you are still working, than if you're somebody who's really qualified but have been out of work for a long time.
There's a signal-to-noise issue here, it seems to be. 192,000 people. Okay, that's a nice number. You want it to be around 200,000. But if you take the long-term unemployed, which is a third of this, these are millions of people, what needs to be done is something for them, and we're actually going in the opposite direction if we talk about unemployment benefits and those sorts of things.
Well, there could be things that perhaps the federal government might want to put in place. For example, if there were tax breaks that were put in place for companies to be encouraged to hire the unemployed, if there were more training programs. But the difficulty, of course, with training programs is how effective they are. When you look at some of the people who've been unemployed for long periods of time, when they found work, they usually find it in the sector where they actually have experience. So there's a question there of, if you're getting training, are you actually going into other fields? If you did, you know, pharmaceutical sales, are you able to learn how to become a coder and take a job there? If you don't have a college degree, are you able to get the sort of skills that can get you the high-end manufacturing job that is out there now? So that's part of the problem here, is finding that match of where the jobs are, where the jobs might be, and these people who are out of work for a long period of time.
Is it too early to have the discussion that economists typically have on the other side of a recession, of what constitutes full employment? Are we not going to get below 6%? Are we not going to get below 5%? Is it going to hover around 7%? Is that conversation starting to happen?
Well, I think you're sort of hearing that all the time right now, which is, if the sort of natural rate of unemployment is around 5% or so, are we in a – I hate to use the word new normal, but are we in a period
natural where that's rate of unemployment? But economists say.
But that, of course, is the worry, and is this what it looks like? But I think in this case, what's particularly interesting is, in previous, you know, recessions or periods like this, the long-term unemployment rate has come down faster. So it's staying really high. So this is implying if you were to lose a job now, you might have a better chance of finding work now quicker than if you have been unemployed for a long period of time. And that's an issue that goes back to really the start of the recession in 2008, that as things started to ramp up, there just weren't enough vacancies at that time. So you have this large cohort of people who have not worked for a long time. And it's very challenging. And when those people, if they do find work, there's a recent study that just came out from the former Council of Economic Advisors chief finding that a lot of those people don't keep their job. There's also the situation that often they've drained their income and they're kind of starting over often. It's a very tough situation to be in.
Well, it's a kind of a disturbing takeaway at the end of the week that people who lost their jobs in 2008 may constitute a kind of a economic dead zone
sort
going
just
forward.
A lingering, right. Lingering on.
Charlie Herman, business and economics editor for WNYC Radio, on the jobs report out today, 6.7% unemployment, a rise of 192,000 in payrolls. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Friday movie date offering now from our own reviewers, Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman of the Movie Date podcast. Kristen and Rafer spoke with actress Scarlett Johansson and her embrace of some very stylized visions of the future, whether as the voice of a computer in last year's Her, to superhero in this year's Captain America the Winter Soldier, to the very hard-to-categorize release Under the Skin. Scarlett Johansson now on Scarlett Johansson.
Maybe the rules are easier to bend in the science fiction genre. Maybe, you know, because we are not tied down to a specific time and place or necessarily things that we can relate to day to day, it allows for greater possibilities, whether that's, you know, in a relationship between not necessarily two of the same species or even something that's really alive. Or once we kind of are sort of liberated by the social norm, we can explore themes and relationships that are much more delicious in some ways, you know.
And it's not just the themes that are unusual and delicious. You also shot the movie in some unusual and delicious ways. Most of your characters' interactions with humans are actually shot with non-actors. You're driving around Scotland asking real people for directions, in some cases giving them rides. Did any of them recognize you, and what was that like?
I've never been a person that's been like a jokester, prankster. I don't like any of that, like, candid camera stuff. I mean, for me, it gives me incredible anxiety just to give up control. And I think once I realized that I couldn't control the situation, I realized the benefit of taking the risk was much greater than, you know, whatever the failure of that risk could be. And it resulted in a lot of really, really fascinating encounters with people. And it's amazing how trusting people really are, and open to share all kinds of details about where they're going, where they came from. People want to connect, I think, with one another.
What about this movie attracted you? Was it the script? Was it the director? Had you read the book or what?
I originally became involved with this project several years ago. The script was much more of a, what I would imagine a science fiction kind of type of film would be. You know, it was a two-hander, you know, female character, male character, both aliens of the same kind of species. And they were sort of trying to submerge themselves in this small village. And it was a much more, and the townsfolk were kind of a part of the story, or are they going to be found out, etc. And it was much more of a contained kind of idea. And, you know, when I met with Jonathan Glazer at that time, the director of Under the Skin, I think he felt liberated by being able to follow this kind of alien perspective.
Now, this character you play, the one that Glazer decided to center the whole film around, has been described as an alien sex predator serial killer. How would you describe her?
You know, the things that are happening in the character's mind before she sort of begins to, I don't know, individualize, I would say, you know, really primal. I mean, she's a different species. It's not, you know, she's not good or evil. She has no moral compass. You know, this character, while it might seem evil to us kind of watching it, the darkness in her is just purely what we're kind of putting, you know, imposing onto her. And so the fact that the character doesn't say anything, it was sort of a reminder that she's not necessarily, not that she's, you know, like vacant, but that she's just shut off. The human, in quotes, part of her is just turned off.
It's a role that that has very little dialogue. So was that a challenge for you, trying to figure out other ways to convey what was happening, also convey what was happening in the mind of someone who is not human?
you know, the performance was almost like a meditation in a way, because, you know, those thoughts just had to come through and like leave and not stay there. Otherwise, like, it was very obvious that this character was having an inner life, which she doesn't have to begin with. Different challenges, I guess, but I feel very fortunate that I'm able to do challenging work like that.
To hear Rafer and Kristen's full interview with Scarlett Johansson, visit moviedatepodcast.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Another voice now from the shadow of Russia's troubled history in Eastern and Central Europe. What has leader Vladimir Putin set in motion with his talk of Russian territorial rights and destiny in Crimea and Ukraine? Poland has asked NATO to station 10,000 troops on its territory this week as what it calls a protective measure. Eva Hoffman grew up in Poland and Ukraine, this territory of the moving borders and changeable maps of the 20th century. Poland spent much of that time in the orbit of the Soviet Union. Hoffman's parents barely survived the Holocaust in a small town outside of Lviv in Ukraine. In her life of exile from Ukraine to Poland to Canada, the U.S., and now London, Hoffman has never forgotten those days of fear and uncertainty. Today, she's an author and professor at Kingston University in London. Eva Hoffman tells us that Russia even today retains the power to remind people of Eastern Europe that everything they have gained since the fall of the Soviet Union might be swept away in an instant.
I grew up in post-war Poland, so therefore in the Soviet sphere. And the Soviet Union basically controlled the countries of Eastern Europe. And it was the great enemy. But basically, the countries of Eastern Europe had been given to the Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union swooped them up by the Yalta Agreement. And the lives of, you know, millions of people were affected for decades to come. So the whole notion of simply, you know, annexing territory, appropriating territory, brings up really very terrible associations, very dark associations.
Well, this goes back before your time, but certainly most people in the West have no notion that the Bolsheviks fought a war on the eastern border of Poland. And that whole eastern front of Ukraine and Poland was in play for years and years after World War I. Do people have memories of the moving map and a sense that these lines can be redrawn at the whim of someone like a Vladimir Putin?
Oh, goodness, yes. You know, I mean, the joke in that part of the world was that you could stay in one place and change nationality three times in your lifetime in the 20th century. And this was true of many people. I mean, my parents grew up in the Polish part of the Ukraine. So I had a very kind of, you know, palpable sense of connection of the existence of that part of the world, even though I didn't go there until the late 90s. But they lived in a small village, a shtetl, as it was called in Yiddish, in which the population was evenly divided among Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews. And in 1940, towards the end of 1944 and 1945, when it was clear that that part of the Ukraine would become part of the Soviet Union, they made their way west. They made a trek westwards towards Poland. It was a very smart move on their part. But the sense of that lost part of Poland was very powerful. And, you know, there are poems written about it. There is an absolutely beautiful kind of keynote poem called To Go to Lviv, Lviv being the Polish name for what is now called Lviv, which is a poem about a kind of lost city. So it was very vivid. It was very palpable.
You know, if you go to Warsaw today and feel the sense of westernization that's taken place in Poland that, you know, in comparison to a lot of places in Europe is doing pretty well, you get the sense that Poland's escaped. Poland is out of that Russian orbit, has stepped away from that 20th century legacy. Do you agree? And if not, what does your gut tell you?
No, I mean, I think that Poland has been the most successful in becoming what they very much wished for, which in their phrase was a normal country. Poland has become a European country and, you know, has a voice in Europe and quite a bit of credibility in Europe. The other countries of Eastern Europe cannot be said to be in the Soviet sphere either. I mean, they have become, several of them, of course, are now part of the European Union. So, yes, they have escaped. Of course, but you know, the sense of Russian danger is there.
Finally, before we go, historians have said to us that Vladimir Putin appears to be deliberately harping on or evoking some of these fears of danger that you described by really playing up meetings between the Russians and Secretary of State John Kerry, in that it looks in the Russian media like this is another Yalta, and that message falls very fearfully on ears in places like Ukraine and even Poland. Do you get that sense?
Well, I must say I haven't thought of it that way. I mean, it seems to me that possibly what is involved in these meetings with Kerry is that Putin is trying to kind of pacify the West while he is, you know, massing his troops on the eastern Ukrainian border, for example, and, you know, while he is getting ready to do whatever he wants next, again, possibly with the sense of impunity, and again, because the West has not been vigilant enough. So really, this is the sense I get from here, in the sense of the possibility of the new Cold War, which I suppose does bring up shades of Yalta.
So if Putin were to say to the West or to say to Eastern Europe, they're going to sell you out. Don't look to Washington and Berlin and London. They're going to sell you out. Look at them. Is that credible?
Well, I don't think he would be listened to. I don't think he would be listened to. But I think the kind of the impotence of the West is very worrying. And I do think we need a stronger response. But I think that what some people in Poland are wishing for, are thinking about, is that if the Ukraine, the non-annexed Ukraine, manages to modernize itself sufficiently, that an alliance between Poland and the Ukraine would be very important, and that it would be precisely a kind of antidote and a counterpoint in Eastern Europe to Russian power. It would be a kind of, you know, a kind of mediating power within Eastern Europe. I think it would be very good if that were to happen.
Once again, Ukraine is in the balance in this very fluid zone in Europe. Eva Hoffman, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Eva Hoffman, author and professor at Kingston University, London, emigrated from Poland to Canada at the age of 13 in 1959. When you're the one left standing there, you reach the final bell. You're the best around. Now, some of you will call this light at the end of the tunnel. You may think of it as an indulgent, sinful peak moment, or the moment when our 3-week-long obsession with television becomes a true overdose. But this is the final day of our greatest character of all time TV bracket competition. The NCAA Final Four Championship will take until Monday night to be decided. We're going to end this takeaway competition right now.
Am I being too critical?
I think she's trying to tell us something.
I do not believe I am qualified to express an opinion.
I don't think you have the talent.
I didn't hear you say that.
I thought you might want to know why I was willing to risk your life for several small machines.
It's inhuman.
Really awful.
I hate this. It is revolting.
Are we going to stand for this? We're going to let them do this to us? No, I say, no!
There they are, the three finalists. The wholesome and annoying Mary Richards of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the nerdy and annoying Data from Star Trek TNG, The Next Generation, and Hawkeye Pierce, the People's Choice candidate from MASH. And since Brent Spiner, who played Data, Mary Tyler Moore, who played Mary Richards, and Alan Alda, the actor behind Hawkeye, were not available for our program, we've got the next best thing. Maybe it's not the next best thing, but the valiant fanboys and girls who defended these competitors throughout the competition are here with us defending Mary, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome.
Love is all around. Take it.
Defending Lieutenant Commander Data, Jolenta Greenberg, Takeaway Administrative Assistant. Welcome.
Make it so. Thank you.
And defending Hawkeye, Dave Keating, one of the many outraged fans who derided us for our omissions throughout this competition. Dave, welcome.
Glad to be here.
All right, Dave, with you. What's your connection to Hawkeye? Just, are you a fan of the show? What's?
I grew up watching. So, yeah, of course, it was special to me and my family. Family would gather around the TV at dinner time and not talk at all or interact at all, just to watch television.
And Jolenta, I've worked with you for years. I did not know this Data thing about you. What's your connection with TNG?
Same as Dave's, really. I watched it growing up, and I loved Data the most because Data had a sort of, you know, childlike curiosity, just like myself at the time.
And Kristen Meinzer, I would never have pegged you for a Mary Richards fan, but fill me in.
She's from Minneapolis, like me. She's a producer, like me. She's an unmarried 30-something lady who's independent and fun. What's not to love about her?
All right, so this is it. You've got a few minutes here, the three of you, to battle this out. The voting, of course, at thetakeaway.org. Who wants to start?
I will take all of you down.
Nice.
You are all going down.
All right, so speaking for Mary Richards, Kristen.
All right, first of all, I have to say she's been an inspiration and the template for a number of other characters out there. We wouldn't have a Liz Lemon without her. We wouldn't have a Murphy Brown. We wouldn't have an Ally McBeal. We wouldn't have the women on Sex and the City. And she's been a great... listen, buddy. If it weren't for her, so many great musicians would be without inspiration. Do these other characters inspire this kind of music?
The theme song of the show wins it for Mary?
Husker Du, Joan Jett, Sammy Davis Jr. Come on. I dare you to say that Data inspires that.
She dares you.
Oh, bring it, Kristen. That's all great that a lot of people sing the theme song for your character, but does your character have a rap?
I've written my next poem in honor of my cat. I call it Ode to Spot. Felis catus, is your taxonomic nomenclature an endothermic quadruped carnivorous by nature? Your visual.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Dave Keating, they are making this easy for you, bud.
Yeah, I mean, this is a slam dunk, as they say. Hawkeye Pierce, he just encapsulated the ethos of the entire show, really. I mean, he was that anti-authoritarian, ribald character who you just fell in love with, right? He made it so easy. It was an ensemble show, but it really became all about him.
No, and they were fantastic characters. You could take characters, I mean, Honeycutt, Radar.
That's true.
I mean, the commander. I mean, Harry Morgan playing that character. But Hawkeye Pierce stands at the top of the pantheon. Let's remind ourselves.
I simply cannot eat the same food every day. Fish, liver, day after day. I've eaten a river of liver and an ocean of fish. I've eaten so much fish, I'm ready to grow gills. I've eaten so much liver, I can only make love if I'm smothered in bacon and onions. Are we going to stand for this? We're going to let them do this to us? No, I say, no! We're not going to eat this dreck anymore! We want something else! We want something else! We want something else!
We want Hawkeye Pierce. He was. That was the kitchen revolt scene.
Right. I mean, the great thing about MASH is, you know, it really embodied a whole decade and an era of the Vietnam generation in so many ways.
Absolutely.
I can't preempt the voting here by saying that, you know, Hawkeye should win, but there was such a groundswell of listeners who wanted Hawkeye, you leading the way.
Well, I think, too, he reflected the societal struggles at the time of the 1970s, right? There was the Vietnam, the OPEC oil embargo, rampant inflation, and he was at war with himself, much like America was at war with itself at that time.
So no, Data doesn't have any societal tension.
I have to say, both of our characters are also dealing with real issues.
Yes. The Data? Struggle what? To be human, the human condition itself, that's not a universal struggle. That's not something that we want to watch and have explored with us in outer space.
Android advocacy from Jolenta Greenberg.
I do have to jump in here and say both of you guys have great characters. I will give it to you. You have great characters. I don't want to completely throw you guys down, but your characters are relying on extreme circumstances to bring out their humanity. War, outer space. I mean, come on. What Mary Richards brings to the table is a real person in a real situation and finding what's important and meaningful and human in that.
Working at a TV station? That's real?
Okay, if I could defend outer space for a moment and Star Trek in general, like MASH is great, Mary Tyler Moore is great, but do either of them have conventions? Do either of them strike something so deep in the public's hearts that there are huge communities devoted to the themes explored?
Well, let me jump in here and say that I'm a huge fan of both shows and both characters, and I'm sure that Brent Spiner is a fan of The Takeaway, and I hope he's not listening, but Data...
Yeah, he really wanted to come on the show.
Yeah. But Data, I mean, come on. He's just a pale shadow of Spock, the origin of the intellectual, you know, non-emotional character that started in the first Star Trek.
Data was a bit part.
Have you ever ridden
in a subway car with a bunch of TNG folks? Okay. It's scary.
No, but here's my argument for Data over Spock. And I thought about this when I nominated Data. I love Spock, and he's super interesting, but Spock has this angst factor that I think makes him much less pure than Data as a well-rounded character. And I like watching a struggle to be human and to be a good human. That's what I struggle with. I don't struggle with how to, like, not have emotions and be a good Vulcan.
You know what, guys? We're going to have to let the listeners decide this. They're going to vote. All I have to say is you've left me thinking, I wonder what it would have been like to have had an episode of MASH with Data and Mary Richards in it. I would watch that.
Sure, a mashup.
I mean, you know, when we were kids, we used to play Doctor. I used to play the receptionist.
I find that interesting.
You're both a disgrace to this outfit.
Oh, come on, Frank. We've all had 12 straight hours of meatball surgery in there.
They would have been destroyed.
Why won't you let me say what I want to say?
You don't trust me.
Not since the first time I found you hiding in my sleeping bag.
On the contrary, I find it rather comforting.
Dave Keating for Hawkeye, Jolenta Greenberg for Lieutenant Commander Data, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, defending Mary Richards. May the best character win. Who's going to make it after all? Vote for Hawkeye Pierce from Hartsville, South Carolina. Data gets a vote from New Canaan, Connecticut. Janet writes, Mary had such great comedic timing. She has my vote. At thetakeaway.org, where you can vote, it's a little more lopsided than that. I won't say how, but go to thetakeaway.org to vote. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.